rushed over to comfort the wounded man and accused Lancelot of being a murderer and carried on a great deal. "Do stop howling," said the man. "He is not a murderer. We just made a mistake." "I was in bed," said Lancelot, "when he came and sat on me, and we were both so startled that we had a fight. I'm sorry that I hurt him."
"But it was our bed," cried the lady, like one of the three bears. "What were you doing in our bed?"
"Really," he said, "I am sorry. There was nobody in the pavilion when I found it, and I was lost and tired, so I thought it would not matter if I took a night's lodging."
"Nor did it matter," said the man. "You are welcome to a night's lodging, and I don't think the wound is going to be a bad one after all. May I inquire your name?"
"Lancelot."
"Well," exclaimed the man, "there now, my dear. Look who I have been fighting. No wonder I got a bit of a chip. I was wondering why my life was spared so easily."
So they insisted that Lancelot should stay the night, and in the morning they put him on the correct road for the Abbey of Whitefriars. Nothing much came of this encounter in the main story, except that the knight, whose name was Belleus, was introduced to the Round Table by Lancelot as soon as he was well again. He was the kind of generous fellow that Arthur needed, and Lancelot tried to make up for the trouble which he had caused by getting him a seat at the table. At the Abbey of Whitefriars, the fair damsel was waiting in a state of excitement. She was afraid that he might have let her down. His horse's hooves, however, had no sooner clattered on the cobbles than she came flying from her tower room to welcome him with delight.
"Father will be here this evening," she cried. "Oh, I am so glad you came. I was afraid you might have forgotten."
Lancelot's twisted mouth grinned at the words she had chosen to use. Then he changed into civilian dress, had a bath, and waited for King Bagdemagus. "It is a puzzling life in Grammarry," he said to himself, trying to keep his mind off the young queen. "Things happen so quickly. One hardly knows where one is half the time. And then there is that cousin of mine who vanished under the apple tree who has still to be accounted for. What with magic queens and faction tournaments and people getting into bed with you at night and half the family vanishing without trace, it is difficult to keep in line." Then he brushed his hair, smoothed his gown, and went down to meet King Bagdemagus. There is no need to give a long description of the tourney. Malory gives it. Lancelot picked three knights who were recommended by the young damsel to go with him, and he arranged that all four of them should bear the vergescu. This was the white shield carried by unfledged knights, and Lancelot insisted on this arrangement because he knew that three of his own brethren of the Round Table were going to fight on the other side. He did not want them to recognize him, because it might cause ill feeling at court. On the other hand, he felt that it was his duty to fight against them because of the promise which he had given to the damsel. The king of Northgalis, who was the leader of the opposite side, had 160 knights in his faction, and King Bagdemagus only had 80. Lancelot went for the first knight of the Round Table and put his shoulder out of joint. He went for the second one so hard that the unlucky fellow was carried over his horse's tail and buried his helm several inches in the ground. He hit the third knight on the head so hard that his nose bled and his horse ran away with him. By the time he had broken the thigh of the king of Northgalis, everybody could see that to all intents and purposes, the tournament was over. The next thing that happened was that our hero set out to discover what had become of Lionel. He was free to do so for the first time, for since the disappearance of his cousin, he had either been imprisoned by the malignant queens, or else he had been discharging his obligations to the girl who had rescued him from them. King Bagdemagus got the prize at the tournament before he left, and the damsel was almost tearfully grateful. Everybody said that they would be friends forever, and that they had only to send each other word if there was anything that anybody could do for anybody in return. Then Lancelot mounted his horse, got his bearing by asking several peasants where he was, and rode off toward the forest of the apple tree, where he had lost his cousin. He thought that by making an all-round-the-hat cast at the place where he had last seen his cousin, he might be able to pick up the scent once more, although it was cold. In the forest of the apple tree, indeed at the very foot of the tree itself, he came across a lady riding a white palfrey. The tree was thought to be a magic one, which was the reason why such a lot of traffic went on round it. "Lady," said he, "do you know of any adventures in this forest?"
"Plenty," she said, "if you are man enough to take them on."
"I could try."
"You look a strong man," said the lady. "You have a bold look, too, in spite of your ears, which stick out so frightfully. If you like, I will take you where the fiercest baron in the world lives, but he is sure to kill you."
"Never mind."
"I will only take you if you tell me your name. It would be murder to take you unless you are a famous knight."
"My name is Lancelot."
"I thought it was," said the lady. "Well, it is lucky it is. According to the things which people are saying about you, you are probably the only knight in the world who can beat the man I am taking you to. His name is Sir Turquine."
"Good."
"Some say he is a madman. He has 64 knights in prison, whom he has captured in single combat, and he spends the time beating them with thorns. If he captures you, he will beat you too, all naked."
"He sounds an exciting man to fight."
"It is a sort of concentration camp."
"That is what I have been getting ready for," said Sir Lancelot. "It is what Arthur invented the Round Table to prevent."
"If I take you to him, you must promise to do something for me afterwards, that is, if you win."
"What sort of thing?" he asked cautiously.
"You need not be afraid," said the lady. "It is only to vanquish another knight I know of, who is distressing some damsels."
"I will promise that gladly."
"Well," said the lady, "God, he knows how you will get on. Anyway, I will say a prayer for you while you are fighting."
When they had been riding for some time, they came to a ford, like the one at which he had fought the first fight with King Arthur. On the trees round the ford there were hanging rusty helms and melancholy shields, 64 of them, with their bens and chevrons and luces horient, and merles and eagles displayed, and lions passant guardant, looking desolate and abandoned. The leather of their gyges was green and mildewy. It looked like a gamekeeper's gallows. In the middle of the glade, on the chief tree, there hung an enormous copper basin, triumphing over the beaten shields. The latest shield under it was Lionel's, argent, a bend gules, distinguished with some sort of label of cadency. Lancelot knew what he had to do with this basin, and he did it. He put his helm in position, rode through the dripping leaves to the basin, and beat on it with the butt of his spear until the bottom fell out. Then he and the lady stood still in the forest, which was as if it had been shocked silent by the hideous noise. Nobody came.
"His castle is beyond," said the lady.
They went to the castle gates in silence, and rode up and down in front of them for half an hour. He took off his helm and gauntlets and frowned and bit his fingernails from anxiety. After the half hour was over, a gigantic knight came riding through the forest. He looked so like Sir Carados, the knight who had been slain at the rescue of Gawain, that Lancelot was startled. Not only was he of the same build, but he also had a bound knight thrown across the saddle bow of his mare. Most peculiar of all, the bound knight's shield carried the three thistles and the chevron, with a red canton. In fact, the second of the big knights had captured Gaheris, Gawain's brother. Lancelot watched him with a critical eye. It may not be amiss to mention that a good judge of style could often recognize a knight in armor, even if he was disguised and bearing the vergescue. In later life, Lancelot sometimes had to fight disguised, because otherwise nobody would fight him. Yet Arthur and the others generally guessed him by his riding. People nowadays can recognize cricketers, even when their faces are too far away to be seen, and so it was then. Lancelot was a good judge of style, because of his long practice. As soon as he had watched Sir Turquine for a moment or two, he noticed that there was a slight weakness in his seat. He remarked to the lady that unless Turquine sat better, he thought he would be able to rescue the prisoners. As it turned out, Turquine did sit better when it came to the tilt, so that this particular criticism came to nothing, but it throws a sidelight on jousting and may have been worth mentioning. The riding was the whole thing. If a man had the courage to throw himself into the fullest gallop at the moment of impact, he generally won. Most men faltered a little, so that they were not at their best momentum. This was why Lancelot constantly gained his tilts. He had what Uncle Dapp called the élan. Sometimes, when he was in disguise, he would ride clumsily on purpose, showing daylight at his seat. But at the last moment, there was always the true dash, so that the onlookers and frequently his wretched opponent could exclaim, "Ah, Lancelot!" even before the lance drove home. "Fair knight," he said, "put down that wounded man and let him rest a little. Then we too can prove our strengths." Sir Turquine rode up to him and said through his teeth, "If you are a knight of the Round Table, it will give me great pleasure to knock you down first and whack you afterwards. I could do that to you and your whole table with you." It seems a tall order. Then they retreated in the usual way, feutered their spears, and charged together like thunder. Lancelot, in the last moment, noticed that he was wrong about Turquine's seat. In the last flash, he realized that Turquine was the finest tilter he had met, that he was coming with a hurl as great as his own, and that his aim was sure. The knights ducked and drew themselves together. The spears struck at the same moment. The horses, checked in mid-career, reared up and fell over backward. The spears burst and went sailing high in the air, turning over and over gracefully like the results of high explosive, and the lady on the palfrey looked away. When she looked again, both horses were down with their backs broken, and the knights lay still. 2 hours later, Lancelot and Turquine were still fighting with their swords. "Stop," said Turquine. "I want to speak to you." Lancelot stopped. "Who are you?" asked Sir Turquine. "You are the finest knight I ever fought with. I never saw a man with such good wind. Listen, I have 64 prisoners in my castle, and I have killed or maimed hundreds of others, but none were as good as you. If you will have peace and be my friend, I will loose my prisoners."
"It is kind of you."
"I will do this for you if you are anybody except one person. If you are he, I must fight you to the death."
"Who is this person?"
"Lancelot," said Turquine. "If you are Lancelot, I must never yield or make friends. He killed my brother Carados."
"I am that man."
Sir Turquine made a hissing through his helm and struck craftily before his enemy was ready.
"Ah, would you?" said Lancelot. "I only had to pretend I was not myself, and I could have had the prisoners safe. But you try to kill me without warning."
Sir Turquine continued to hiss.
"I am sorry about Carados," said Lancelot. "He was killed in fair fight and never offered to yield. I never had him at mercy. He was killed in the middle of the fight."
They fought for 2 more hours. The blade was not the only weapon used by knights in armor. Sometimes they struck each other with the edges of their shields. Sometimes they clubbed each other with the pommels of their swords. The grass all round was speckled with their blood, little spots like those on trout, but with a kind of tail on each spot like a tadpole. Sometimes, because of their weight, they fell over each other. The heavy, straw-stuffed helms of chivalry had such small holes to breathe through that they felt like suffocating. their shields hung wearily, not covering them properly. It was over in a second. Neither of them spoke. Lancelot dropped his sword at a moment of opportunity and caught Turquin by the snout of his helm. They fell over, and the helm came off. They drew their misericords for the close work. Turquin bounced and shuddered and was dead. Later, while Gaheris and the lady were giving him some water, Lancelot said, "Whatever was wrong with him, he was game. I am sorry he would not yield." "But think of the maimed knights and the beating." "He was the old school," he said. "It is what we have to stop. But he was a credit to the old school as a fighter, all the same."
"He was a brute," said the lady.
"Whatever he was fond of his brother. Look, Gaheris, will you lend me your horse? I want to go on, and my own is dead, poor creature. If you could lend me yours, you could go forward and let Lionel and the others out of the castle. Tell Lionel to go back to court and not to be a silly fellow. I have to ride with this lady. Will you do that?"
"You can have my horse, certainly," said Gaheris. "You have saved him and me as well. How you keep on saving the Orkneys! Last time it was Gawain, and Agravain is in the castle this minute. Of course you can have my horse, Lancelot. Of course you can."
Chapter 8. Lancelot had several other adventures during his first quest. It lasted a year, but perhaps only two are worth repeating in detail. They were both mixed up with the conservative ethics of force majeure, against which the king had started his crusade. It was the old school, the Norman baronial attitude, which provided the adventures of this period, for few people can hate so bitterly and so self-righteously as the members of a ruling caste which is being dispossessed. The Knights of the Round Table were sent out as a measure against Fort Maine, and the choleric barons who lived by Fort Maine took up the cudgels with the ferocity of despair. They would have written to the Times about it if there had been such a paper. The best of them convinced themselves that Arthur was new-fangled, that his knights were degenerate from the standards of their fathers. The worst of them made up uglier names than Bolshevist, even, and allowed the brutal side of their natures to dwell on imaginary enormities which they attributed to the knights. The situation became divorced from common sense, so that atrocity stories were accepted by the atrocious people. Many of the barons whom Lancelot had to put down had worked themselves into such a state about him through fear of losing their ancient powers that they believed him to be a sort of poison gas man. They fought him with as much unscrupulousness and hatred as if he had been an antichrist, and they truly believed themselves to be defending the right. It became a civil war of ideologies. One day in the fine summer, he was riding through the parkland of a castle which was strange to him. The trees grew dispersedly about the sward, great elms and oaks and beeches, and Lancelot was thinking about Guinevere with a heavy heart. Before he had parted from the lady who led him to Sir Turquin, and he had done the thing for her which he had promised, they had started a conversation about marriage, which had upset him. The lady had said that he ought either to have a wife or a mistress, and Lancelot had been angry. "I can't stop people from saying things if they want to," he had said, "but circumstances make it impossible for me to marry, while I consider that having a mistress is no good." They argued about it for some time, and then parted. Now, although he had passed several adventures in between, he was still thinking of the lady's advice and feeling wretched. There was the sound of bells in the air, and he looked up immediately. A fine peregrine falcon, with her music jingling in the whistling wind out clear and her creance trailing behind her, was beating along above his head toward the top of one of the elms. She was in a temper. As soon as she reached the top of the elm, she sat down in it, looking about her with raging eye and panting beak. The creance wrapped itself three times round the nearest bough. When she noticed Sir Lancelot riding toward her, she tried to fly away again in fury. The creance caught her. She hung upside down, baiting with her wings. His heart came into his mouth for fear that she would break some feathers. In a few moments she ceased to flap, and hung upside down, revolving slowly, looking ignoble and indignant and ridiculous, holding her head the right way up, like a snake's.
"Oh, Sir Lancelot! Sir Lancelot!" cried an unknown gentlewoman, riding toward him at full speed, and evidently trying to wring her hands in spite of the reins. "Oh, Sir Lancelot, I have lost my falcon!"
"There she is," he said, "in that tree."
"Oh, dear, oh, dear!" cried the lady. "I was only trying to call her in cranes, and the string broke. My husband will kill me if I do not catch her again. He is so hasty and such a keen falconer."
"But surely he will not kill you."
"Oh, he will. He will not mean it, but he will do it. He is such a hasty man."
"Perhaps I could stop him."
"Oh, no," said the gentlewoman. "That would not do at all. You might hurt him. I would not like you to hurt my dear husband. Don't you think you could climb up the tree and catch the hawk instead?"
Lancelot looked at the gentlewoman and at the tree. Then he heaved a deep sigh and remarked, as Malory reports him, "Well, fair lady, since that ye know my name and require me of my knighthood to help you, I will do what I may to get your hawk. And yet truly I am an ill climber, and the tree is passing high, and few boughs to help me withal." He had spent his childhood learning to be a fighter. It had left him no time for birds nesting, like other boys. The lady's request, which would have given no trouble to people brought up like Arthur or Gawain, really was an upset for him. Lancelot took off his armour sadly, with an occasional crooked glance at the horrible tree, until he was dressed in his shirt and breeches. Then he assaulted the first boughs manfully, while the gentlewoman ran about underneath, talking about hawks and husbands and the nice weather they were having. "All right," he said, with his eyes full of bark and a hideous scowl on his face. "All right, all right." At the top of the tree, the falcon was in such a tangle with her creance — she had wound it round her neck and wings, as usual, and was under the impression that it was assaulting her — that Lancelot had to let her stand on his bare hand. This she gripped with the fury of hysteria, but he patiently disentangled her without minding the stabs. Falconers seldom fuss when their hawks hurt them. They're too interested. When the hawk was safely rescued from the branches, he realized that he would not be able to climb down again with one hand. He shouted to the lady, who seemed small at the foot of the tree, "Look out! I'm going to tie her jesses to a heavy branch, if I can break one off, and then throw her down. I will get one that is not too heavy, so that she comes gently. I shall have to throw her out a bit, so that she is clear of the boughs."
"Oh, do be careful!" cried the lady.
When Lancelot had done what he said, he began to make his way down again with care. There were some bad bits on the way, where he had to rely on balance alone. He was about 20 feet from the ground when a fat knight in full armour came galloping up.
"Ha! Sir Lancelot!" shouted the fat knight. "Now I have you where I want you!"
The lady picked up the falcon and began to go away.
"Lady!"
said Lancelot, wondering how everybody came to know his name. The fat man screamed out,
"You leave her alone, you assassin! That is my wife, that is! She has only been doing what I told her. It was a trick! Ha ha! Now I've got you without any of your famous armour on, and I'm going to kill you, like drowning a kitten."
"It is not very knightly," said Lancelot with a grimace. "You might at least let me arm and fight fair."
"Let you arm, you puppy? Whatever do you take me for? I don't want any of this new-fangled nonsense. When I catch a man who eats human children roasted,
I kill him, like the vermin he is. But really, calm down, I can't wait about all day. Calm down and take your medicine like a man, if you are a man. I assure you that I do not roast children.
The fat knight grew quite purple in the face and shouted,
Liar, liar, devil, come down at once.
Lancelot sat on a branch and dangled his feet and bit his fingernails.
Do you mean to say, he asked, that you loosed that falcon on purpose with her cranes on, so as to be able to murder me when I was naked? Come down.
If I come down, I shall do my best to kill you.
Buffoon!
Cried the fat knight.
Well, said Lancelot, it is your own fault. You should not play dirty tricks. For the last time, will you let me arm like a gentleman? Certainly not!
Lancelot broke off a bough of rotten wood and jumped down on the other side of his horse, so that the horse was between them. The fat knight rode at him and tried to swipe off his head, leaning across the horse between. Lancelot parried the stroke with his bow, and the knight's sword stuck in the wood. Then he took the sword away from its owner and slit his throat.
Go away, said Lancelot to the gentlewoman. Stop howling. Your husband was a fool and you were a bore. I am not sorry I killed him.
But he was sorry. The last adventure was also concerned with treachery and a lady. The young man was riding mournfully through the fen country, which had not been drained in those days and was probably the wildest part of England. It was all secret ways through the marshes, which were known only to the Saxon marshmen who had been conquered by Uther Pendragon, and the whole sea-smelling plain was one vast quack under the low sky. The bitterns boomed, and the marsh harriers skimmed over the reeds, and millions of widgeon and mallard and tufted ducks flew about in various wedges, looking like champagne bottles balanced on a nimbus of wings. On the salt marshes the geese from Spitsbergen walked and nibbled, with their necks bent into their peculiar loop, and the fen men stalked them with nets and engines. The fen people had spotted bellies and their toes were webbed. At any rate, that was the belief in the rest of England. They generally killed foreigners.
While Lancelot was riding along a straight road which seemed to lead nowhere, he saw two people galloping towards him from the other end. They turned out to be a knight and his lady. The lady was in front, going like mad, and the knight was after her. His sword flashed against the dull sky.
"Here! Here!"
cried Lancelot, riding at them.
"Help!" screamed the lady. "Oh, save me! He is trying to cut my head off!"
"Leave her alone! Get out!" shouted the knight. "She is my wife, and she has been committing adultery!"
"I never did!" wailed the lady. "Oh, sir, save me from him! He is a cruel, beastly brute! Just because I am fond of my cousin German, he is jealous. Why should I not be fond of my cousin German?"
"Scarlet woman!"
exclaimed the knight, and he tried to get at her. Lancelot rode between them and said, "Really, you must not go for a woman like that. I don't care whose fault it is, but you can't kill women."
"Since when?"
"Since King Arthur was king."
"She is my wife," said the knight. "She has nothing to do with you. Get out! And she is an adulteress, whatever she says."
"Oh, no, I am not," said the lady. "But you are a bully, and you drink."
"Who made me drink, then? And besides, it is no worse to drink than be an adulteress."
"Be quiet," said Lancelot, "both of you. This is a nuisance. I shall have to ride between you until you cool off. I suppose you would not care to have a fight with me, sir, instead of killing this lady."
"Certainly not," said the knight. "I know by your argent, a bend gules, that you are Lancelot, and I would not be such a fool as to fight you, especially for a bitch like this. What the devil has it got to do with you?"
"I will go," said Lancelot, "as soon as you promise on your knighthood not to kill women.
Well, I won't promise.
You wouldn't, said the lady. Anyway, you wouldn't keep your promise if you did.
There are some marsh soldiers, said the knight, cantering after us. Look behind. They are armed, cap a pie.
Lancelot reined his horse and looked over his shoulder. At the same moment, the knight leaned over to his near side and swapped off the lady's head. When Lancelot looked back again, without seeing any soldiers, he found the lady sitting beside him, with no head on. She slowly began to sag to the left, throbbing horribly, and fell in the dust. There was blood all over his horse. Lancelot grew white about the nostrils. He said, I shall kill you for that. The knight immediately jumped off his horse and lay on the ground.
Don't kill me, he said. Mercy, she was an adulteress.
Lancelot dismounted also and drew his sword.
Get up, he said. Get up and fight you.
The knight scrambled along the ground toward him and threw his arms round his thighs. By being close to the avenger, he made it difficult for him to swing the sword.
Mercy!
His objection made Lancelot feel horrible.
Get up, he said. Get up and fight. Look, I will take my armor off and fight you with my sword only.
But mercy, mercy,
was all the knight would say. Lancelot began to shudder, not at the knight, but at the cruelty in himself. He held his sword loathingly and pushed the knight away.
Look at all the blood, he said.
Don't kill me, said the knight. I yield. You can't kill a man at mercy.
Lancelot put up his sword and went back from the knight, as if he were going back from his own soul. He felt in his heart cruelty and cowardice, the things which made him brave and kind.
Get up, he said. I won't hurt you. Get up, go.
The knight looked at him on all fours like a dog and stood up, crouching uncertainly. Lancelot went away and was sick. At the Feast of Pentecost, it was customary for the knights who had been on table quests to gather again at Carlion so as to relate their adventures. Arthur had found that this made people keener on fighting in the new way of right, if they had to tell about it afterwards. Most of them preferred to bring their prisoners with them, as witnesses to their stories. It was as if some inspector general of police in a very distant part of Africa were to send out his superintendents into the jungle, asking them to come back next Christmas with all the savage chiefs whom they had brought to righteousness. For one thing, it impressed the savage chiefs to see the great court, and they often went home reformed. The Pentecost next, after Lancelot's first quest, was almost a fiasco. A few seedy giants of the strong arm, who had been captured by the Orkney faction, turned up and said their homage, but the Lancelot contingent was a spate.
Whose man are you?
Lancelot's.
And whose are you, my good fellow?
Lancelot's.
After a bit the whole table began shouting the answers. Arthur would say, You are welcome to Carlion, Sir Bellairs, and may I ask which of my knights you have yielded to?
Lancelot!
The table would shout in chorus, and Sir Bellairs, blushing rather, and wondering whether the laughter was at him, would say in a small voice, Yes, I yielded to Sir Lancelot. Sir Bedivere came and admitted how he had swapped off his adulterous wife's head. He had brought it with him, and was told to take it to the Pope as a penance. He became very holy after that. Gawain came gruffly and told in Scottish English how he had been rescued from Sir Carados. Gaheris, at the head of a deputation of 64 knights with rusty shields, related his rescue from Sir Turquin. The daughter of King Bagdemagus arrived in an enthusiastic state and told about the tournament with the King of Northgalis. Besides these, there were many people from adventures which we have left out, mainly knights who had yielded to Sir Lancelot when he was disguised as Sir Kay. You may remember from the first book that Kay was inclined to throw his tongue a bit too much,
and he had got himself unpopular on account of this.
Lancelot had been compelled during the quest to rescue him from three knights who were pursuing him. Then, so that Kay could get home to court unmolested, Lancelot had changed armour with him one night while he was asleep, and thereafter the knights who went for Lancelot, under the impression that he was Kay, had gotten the surprise of their lives, while the knights who met Kay in Lancelot's armour had given him a wide berth. Knights yielded under this category included Gawain, Uwain, Sagramour, Ector de Maris, and three others. Also there came a knight called Sir Meliot de Logre, who had been rescued under supernatural circumstances. All these people gave themselves up, not to King Arthur, but to Guinevere. Lancelot had kept himself away for a whole year, but there was a limit to his endurance. Thinking of her all the time, and longing to be back with her, he had allowed himself this one indulgence. He had sent his captives to kneel at her feet. It was a fatal course of action. Chapter 9. It is difficult to explain about Guinevere, unless it is possible to love two people at the same time. Probably it is not possible to love two people in the same way, but there are different kinds of love. Women love their children and their husbands at the same time, and men often feel a lusty thought for one woman while they are feeling a love of the heart for another. In some way such as this, Guinevere did come to love the Frenchman, without losing her affection for Arthur. She and Lancelot were hardly more than children when it began, and the king was about 8 years their senior. At 22, the age of 30 seems to be the verge of senility. The marriage between her and Arthur had been what they call a maid marriage. That is to say, it had been fixed by treaty with King Leodegrance without consulting her. It had been a successful union, as maid marriages generally are, and before Lancelot came on the scene, the young girl had adored her famous husband, even if he was so old. She had felt respect for him, with gratitude, kindness, love, and a sense of protection. She had felt more than this. You might say that she had felt everything except the passion of romance. And then the captives arrived. A blushing queen of little more than 20 summers on her throne, and the whole flame-lit hall filling with noble knights on bended knee. "Whose prisoner are you?" "I am the queen's prisoner, to live or die, sent by Sir Lancelot." "Who's you?" "The queen's by Lancelot's arm." Sir Lancelot, the name on everybody's lips, the best knight in the world, top of the averages, even above Tristram. The courtly, the merciful, the ugly, the invincible. And he had sent them all to her. It was like a birthday party. So many presents. It was like the storybooks. Guinevere sat straight and bowed royally to her prisoners. She pardoned them all. Her eyes were brighter than her crown. Lancelot came last. There was a stir among the torchbearers near the door, and a sound went round the hall. The clatter of knives and plates and tankards, the noise of friendly shouting which had sounded a moment before like a meeting of seabirds on St. Kilda, the yells for more mutton or a pint of mead, were stilled, and the blurs of white faces turned toward the door. There was Lancelot, no longer in armour, but dressed in a magnificent velvet robe, scalloped and diapered. He hesitated in the dark frame, hideous and friendly, wondering why the silence was, and the lights showed him up. Then the faces turned back again, the seabird meeting started once more, and Lancelot came forward to kiss the king's hand. It was the moment. Perhaps it is better than trying to explain.
"Well, Lance," said Arthur cheerfully, "these are some high jinks, and no mistake about it. Jenny can hardly sit still with all her captives."
They were for her, said Lancelot.
The queen and he did not look at each other. They had done so with the click of two magnets coming together the moment that he crossed the threshold.
I can't help thinking they were for me too, said the king. The result ought to be that you have made me a present of about 3 counties.
Lancelot felt a need to prevent silence. He began talking too quickly.
3 counties is not much, he said, for the emperor of all Europe. You speak as if you had never conquered the dictator of Rome. How are your dominions getting on?
They are getting on as you make them, Lance. It was no good conquering the dictator unless you and the others do the civilizing part. What is the use of being the emperor of Europe if the whole place is fighting mad?
Guinevere supported her hero in the effort against silence. It was their first partnership.
You are a strange man, she said, Arthur dear. You fight all the time, and conquer countries, and win battles, and then you say that fighting is a bad thing.
So it is a bad thing. It is the worst thing in the world. Oh, God, we needn't explain it again.
No.
How is the Orkney faction? Asked the younger man hastily. How is your famous civilization going? Might for right. You mustn't forget I've been away a year.
The king put his head in his hands and looked miserably at the table between his elbows. He was a kind, conscientious, peace-loving fellow who had been afflicted in his youth by a tutor of genius. Between the two of them, they had worked out their theory that killing people and being a tyrant over them was wrong. To stop this sort of thing, they had invented the idea of the table, a vague idea like democracy or sportsmanship or morals. And now, in an effort to impose a world of peace, he found himself up to the elbows in blood. When he was feeling healthy, he did not grieve much, because he knew the dilemma was inevitable. But in weak moments, he was persecuted by shame and indecision. He was one of the first Nordic men who had invented civilization, or who had desired to do otherwise than Attila the Hun had done, and the battle against chaos sometimes did not seem to be worth fighting. He often thought that it might have been better for all his dead soldiers to be alive, even if they had lived under tyranny and madness, rather than be quite dead.
"The Orkney faction is bad," he said. "So is civilization, except for the bit which you have just brought in. Before you came, I was thinking that I was the emperor of nothing. Now I feel as if I were the emperor of 3 counties."
"What is wrong with the Orkney faction?"
"Oh, God, must we talk about it when we were feeling happy because you had come back? I suppose we must."
"It is Morgause," said the queen.
"Partly. Morgause is having love affairs with anybody she can get hold of, now that Lot is dead. How I wish King Pellinore had not had that unfortunate accident when he killed him. It's having a bad effect on her children."
"How do you mean?"
The king scratched on the table and stated,
"I wish you had not conquered Gawain that time when you were disguised as Kay. I almost wish you had not made such brilliant successes in rescuing him and his brothers from Carados and Turquin."
"Why not?"
"This round table," said the older man slowly, "was a good thing when we thought of it. It was necessary to invent a way for the fighting men to express themselves without doing harm. I can't see how we could have done it otherwise than by starting a fashion like children. To get them in, we had to have a gang, as kids have in schools. Then the gang had to swear a darksome oath that they would only fight for our ideas. You could call it for civilization. What I meant by civilization when I invented it was simply that people ought not to take advantage of weakness, not violate maidens and rob widows, and kill a man when he was down. People ought to be civil. But it has turned into sportsmanship. Merlin always said that sportsmanship was the curse of the world, and so it is. My scheme is going wrong. All these knights now are making a fetish of it. They're turning it into a competitive thing. Merlin used to call it games mania. Everybody gossips and nags and hints and speculates about who unseated whom last, and who has rescued most virgins, and who is the best knight of the table. I made it a round table to prevent that very thing. But it has not prevented it. The Orkney faction have got the craze worst. I suppose their sense of insecurity over their mother makes it necessary for them to be sure of a safe place at the top of the list. They have to excel to make up for her. That is why I wish you had not beaten Gawain. He is a decent chap, but he will hold it against you inside himself. You've hurt him in his tilting average. It is a part of their make-up which has now become more important to my knights than their souls. If you are not careful, you will have the Orkney faction after your blood, as well as after poor Pellinore's. It's a foul position. People will do the basest things on account of their so-called honour. I wish I had never invented honour or sportsmanship or civilization.
What a speech, said Lancelot. Cheer up. The faction won't hurt me, even if it does come after my blood. As for your scheme going wrong, that's nonsense. The round table is the best thing that ever happened.
Arthur, whose head was still in his hands, raised his eyes. He saw that his friend and his wife were looking at each other with the wide pupils of madness, so he quickly attended to his plate. Chapter 10 Uncle Dap said, turning the helm round in his hands, "Your mantling is cut and torn. We shall have to get another. It is honourable to have the mantling slashed, but dishonourable to keep it so when there is an opportunity to replace it. Such a course of action would be boastful."
They were talking in a little closet with a north window, cold and grey, and the blue light lay like frozen oil upon the steel.
"Yes." "How did Joyeux go? Is he sharp still? Did you like his balance?"
Joyeux had been made by Galland, the greatest swordsmith of the Middle Ages.
"Yes." "Yes, yes," cried Uncle Dap. "Can you say nothing but yes? Death of my soul, Lancelot, but one asks if you are dumb. What in the world is this that has come over you in the end?"
Lancelot had been smoothing the panache of feathers, which was used as a distinguishing mark on the helm in Uncle Dap's hands. It was detachable. People have got it into their heads through the cinema and the comic advertisements that knights in armour generally wore ostrich plumes, nodding like stalks of pampas grass. This was not the case. Kay's panache, for instance, was shaped like a rigid, flat fan, with its edges pointing fore and aft. It was carefully arranged out of the eyes of peacock feathers, exactly as if a stiff peacock fan had been erected endwise on his head. It was not a tuft of plumes, and it did not nod. It was rather like the adipose fin of a fish, but gaudy. Lancelot, who did not care for gaudy things, wore a few heron's hackles bound with silver thread, which suited the argent of his shield. He had been stroking them. Now he threw them violently into a corner and stood up. He began walking the narrow room in a jerky way.
"Uncle Dap," he said, "do you remember how I asked you not to talk about something?"
"I do."
"Is Guinevere in love with me?"
"You should ask her," replied his uncle, with French logic.
"What must I do?" he cried. "What must I do?"
If it is difficult to explain about Guinevere's love for two men at the same time, it is almost impossible to